True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Sacramento police are still looking for a boarding house manager they say literally dug an early grave for some of her tenants. Police say her motive was simple, money.
Very rancid, sometimes sweet, sickly sweet odor. Definitely something dead.
Will McIntyre says he knew something didn't smell right next door. But he and others who had complained had no idea their neighbor's backyard had become a cemetery. Crews pulled a fifth body from a shallow grave today. Wrapped in a sheet, police couldn't tell if the victim was male or female. But they believe it's a former tenant of this boarding home, one of the eight elderly people who lived here and was recently reported missing. The woman believed responsible for the deaths is 71-year-old Dorothea Montalvo Puentes, who had a previous record of stealing from the elderly after doping them. Authorities now suspect the woman killed at least five of the tenants and continued to cash their Social Security checks. She was seen at the boarding house early yesterday, hours after the first body was found in the backyard. Police today tried to defend their actions of questioning Puentes, but not arresting her. Do you think it was a mistake for you guys not to follow her?
No, ma'am. She was free to go. I have no more right to follow her than I have a right to follow you. You have to understand that. Nobody wants her in jail worse than I do, people, but I'm going to do the laws. It's very important that we do not ruin the consent to search.
Police did arrest this man, 59-year-old John McCauley, a friend of Puentes and a resident of the home. Authorities believe McCauley helped Puentes dig the graves. He was booked this afternoon in the Sacramento County Jail on an investigation of accessory to murder. Tomorrow, the digging continues, with less than one half of the yard uncovered. Police don't know what else they might find.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
There are vulnerable people in society who the rest of us have a moral obligation to protect and defend from those who would take advantage of them or abuse them. Of course, we often fail with this. But when someone dedicates their life to helping these people, who society has basically cast out, it's an honorable thing. This is a person we can all admire as selfless and kind. We may even overlook some ominous signs of exploitation. Dorothea Puente ran a boarding home for disabled and elderly people who had nowhere else to go. Many of them were mentally ill and incapable of caring for themselves. She came across as maternal and selfless, cooking and cleaning for her boarders without any complaint. But she did have a temper, and she had a criminal history. The crimes in Dorothea's boarding house were shocking and heinous, so much so that she would earn the moniker Death House Landlady. It would take time for anyone to notice the missing tenants and to connect the horrible, sickly sweet odor of decomposition to their disappearances. Today we're finding out how Dorothea Puentes became a thief and a serial killer, and how she got away with murdering the people who depended on her while cashing their checks and spending their Social Security benefits on clothing and booze. We're calling this episode Tales of a Death House Landlady, because we can, and because I think it neatly sums up this story.
Yes, it does. So this crime, or crimes, occurred in Sacramento, California. Now, I had this great recommendation from Roberta to review a Sacramento beer, so I have one called Nuckenfutz Imperial Peanut Butter Chocolate Cream Porter, brewed by Track 7 Brewing Company in Sacramento. And I think the title, or the name of the beer, says it all. Imperial Peanut Butter Chocolate Cream Porter. That covers it.
Sounds pretty delicious.
It actually is fairly good.
Oh, good.
So I will preface this by saying I'm not a big peanut butter and beer fan.
It is an odd combination.
But this worked pretty well. So it's an American porter. It's a Coca-Cola color with a nice head that rapidly fades. And the aroma is peanut butter and milk chocolate. Bam. Then the taste is milk chocolate first, little vanilla cream, and it is nutty, but not as much as you got from the aroma. And there's a nice sweet finish. This is a medium-bodied beer, pretty enjoyable to drink. It's only 7.3% alcohol by volume, so it's not a killer. Try it.
I think I like the 7% range, you know, because 4 or 5, it doesn't seem like it's quite enough alcohol sometimes. But then once you get up like 8, 9, 10, then you need a nap afterwards.
Well, not always.
Well, maybe not you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's open it up and go down to the quiet end.
All right. Let's do it.
Okay. Very quiet here at the quiet end.
It is. Well, you know, it's the day after Christmas. Who's out and about?
Everybody's not many people.
Home enjoying their families and
That's
stuff.
That's right. Recovering.
Dorothea Puente was born in January 1929. She was born in San Bernardino County in California to two alcoholics. Not maybe a good start, huh?
No.
Her father was a cotton picker. Now, both parents abused her, and she often had to scavenge for food. Her father died when she was 4. I think he had tuberculosis.
Oh, that's a hard way to die, isn't it?
Yeah. And then 2 years later, when she was 6, her mother died. So she went to an orphanage until relatives from Fresno, California, took her in. The remainder of the family had lost track of her early on. After the orphaned children were split up, Dorothea was shifted from household to household. When she was 15, she moved with her oldest brother and his wife to a small house in Napa, a small charming town in California's not quite yet famous wine country. So in Napa, James and Louise Gray took her in, and school records show that Dorothea transferred as a ninth grader to Napa Junior High mid-year in November of 1944. She was very popular at this new school. She told everybody she was an exchange student from Portugal. English was difficult for her, she said, so she had to have her homework translated every night. But she bragged to the kids that she was a math whiz, able to solve problems that stumped even Einstein. She was a fascinating new member of the school and quickly caught the attention of the school newspaper. And so this is kind of, I think, a typical thing that kids would do, teenagers, right?
Really?
You're in this new school, you got to play yourself up a little bit.
Oh, but this is so extreme.
Well.
This isn't normal. To say that you're from another country and English is hard for you, that's pretty extreme.
I don't think too much.
Really?
But I like the part about doing math problems that stump even Einstein.
Yeah, I think that's really kind of a sign of someone who has some issues. A compulsive liar, if nothing else.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, and I think she's just trying to establish herself at the new school.
Well, sure, but that's pretty desperate and extreme.
That's extravagant, though, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. The school principal read the newspaper and read about this new exchange student. And they, of course, knew that Dorothea was not from Portugal, and they were alarmed with how easily she'd created this whole new persona. They called her brother's wife to tell her that Dorothea needed counseling. But this suggestion really fell on deaf ears, and soon Dorothea was gone. She left abruptly in January of 1945, less than 3 months after she entered the school. Now, back in Los Angeles, she stayed with a sister's adoptive family for a few months, and enrolled in Garfield High School. Then she quickly switched to Whitney High School, which she attended until the next June. But Dorothea would never actually graduate. At 16, she ran away and traveled north to Olympia, Washington. Now, part of the time she was scooping ice cream and she called herself Sherry. The rest of the time, she and a friend were sharing a motel room working as prostitutes. So maybe if you think about this, you'll see that she wasn't quite normal.
No, this is a pretty shitty upbringing, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, youth. I don't think she's brought up by too many people.
No, she seems like she was kind of out on her own early.
Yeah. So when she's 17, she met a guy named Fred McFall. He was a 22-year-old soldier just back from the Philippines. Now, Fred was willing to overlook the fact that she was a prostitute. He took her to Reno and married her in 1945. She was underage, but she said that she was 30 and widowed, and she signed the register as Cherielle A. Russell.
Yeah, so kind of a French-sounding name. Maybe she's trying to sound exotic. I don't know.
I think that's an exotic-sounding name.
Well, using aliases seemed to come easily to Dorothea. She could pass for anyone she wanted by the way that she acted. She had made up this name, Sherry L. Riskell, out of nowhere. McFall didn't know how she even came up with it. Lies could just pop out of her in an instant. She was good at it. Now the couple set up house in Gardnerville, Nevada. Fred took a job as a bartender at the Golden Bubble Club. And Dorothea told everyone that she was Fred's nurse in the war in the Philippines, and he'd brought her back.
The stories just get better and better, don't they?
They do. Now, their first daughter, named Diane Lorraine, was born in September 1946, and that was just before their first anniversary. A second daughter, Melody Jean, arrived less than a year later in August of 1947. Unfortunately, motherhood and domesticity didn't hold much interest for her. After the birth of her second daughter, she took off for Los Angeles, leaving her babies and her husband behind. Weeks later, she just as suddenly reappeared.
So what'd she do? She needed a break?
She just disappeared and then reappeared.
She took off and came back. Now her husband
Who
Fred...
Who knows what happened while she was gone, though, right?
Right. Her husband Fred died of a heart attack within another couple of years. So she's without work, without job, right?
As far as I know, she didn't work.
She has two kids.
She was always scamming, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So for money, she would forge checks. But she got caught and was sentenced to a year in jail. She was paroled after 6 months. Soon after she got out, she was impregnated by a man she barely knew and gave birth to a baby girl who she had to give up for adoption.
One of her daughters from Fred went to live with her paternal grandmother, and the other one was put up for adoption as well. Free of her children, she began a larcenous shopping spree in Southern California, and she was arrested. She pleaded guilty to 2 counts of forgery, one for writing a fictitious check, and she served about 4 months in jail that time.
So she's not even 20 years old, or just about 20, and she's been in jail twice.
Yes.
Already.
Well, she started lying and doing crimes at a very young age, and seems like maybe it started out to survive. You can almost feel some sympathy there at that point.
Yeah, but not at this point.
No, once she's 20, you don't feel sorry for her anymore?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I think at this point, she certainly should know right from wrong.
Well, did she give up her kids and then go out write these checks? Or was she trying to write the checks to support her children and then she lost her children? Because that would make it different for me, the way I look at it.
Yeah, I get the impression from the book we read that she dumped the kids and then started her spree.
Okay. So you don't think she lost the kids? You think she purposely left them behind?
I do.
Okay. All right. Well, there was a psychiatrist who interviewed her in jail, and he believed that her crimes were brought on by a compelling need to buy clothes and reestablish her own self-esteem. He determined that she was not a true criminal, but rather a situational offender, which... nowadays, I think that term has kind of gone by the wayside, situational offender, because we're all in situations. I mean,
we are, aren't we?
Yeah. So it's really hard to say.
Yeah, this was a few years ago.
But of course, she turned out to be a true criminal.
Yeah. Now she got 3 years probation after she served her 4 months in jail. She skipped town 6 months after her probation started. She had left her probation officer with a phony forwarding address. So there she is in the wind.
Yeah, but that was easy to do back then, I would imagine. There's no computer trail.
There isn't.
It's much easier
Plus,
to do that.
How much are they going to look for? This is pretty low-key crimes.
Right.
So.
But you think, at least nowadays, it could really hold her back from getting credit or getting a job.
Oh,
or
it certainly would.
Things like that.
But not in the early 50s, late
no.
40s.
And a lot of the work she got was under the table type of stuff anyway.
Yeah.
Now, she was in San Francisco in 1952 at the age of 23, where she married a 25-year-old Swede named Axel Berndt Johansson. So, inventing her most inventive identity yet, she called herself Teja Singola Nayardia. I don't know about the pronunciation of that, but she claimed that her father was Egyptian and her mother was an Israeli and that she was Muslim. Now, at first, her husband believed that. He was a merchant seaman at the time, so he was gone for long times. And Dorothea would spend time with many different men while he was gone. Now, sometimes he would return from months at sea to find some new man living with his wife. Sometimes he found expensive merchandise in the home. And sometimes she would take his money and she'd go gambling in Reno. And, you know, lose a lot of it.
Yeah. So then the neighbors weren't real happy with Mrs. Johansson either. I mean, whenever Axel came home, they complained to him that taxis arrived at his doorstep hour after hour, dropping off strange men. So finally, Axel figured out that his wife was earning money as a prostitute.
And I think she did that for a long time. That was her fallback, was using her body and her relative attractiveness.
Yeah, I think so. So by 1960, she was 31 years old, and she was arrested for residing in a house of ill fame. Now, Dorothea protested that she'd only been staying with a friend and hadn't realized she was in a brothel. But she was sentenced to 90 days in jail. After her release, she was rearrested, this time for vagrancy, and was sentenced to another 90 days in jail. So following this release from prison, she began her criminal career that over time became much more serious. She found work as a nurse's aide and was caring for disabled and elderly people in private homes. In a short time, she started managing boarding houses.
Right, so here's where she gets into real trouble.
This is the start of the big time.
In 1961, tired of her cheating, drinking, and wild stories, she also had made some false suicide attempts, which she felt were just for attention. Axel Johansson had her committed to DeWitt State Hospital in Stockton. Records there describe her as very obese and infantile. She told them that she could speak Arabic, Greek, Spanish, and Swedish, and doctors there decided she was just a pathological liar, suffering from an unstable personality, and they gave her prognosis as guarded. Despite their many long separations, or maybe because of them, the Johansons were legally married for 14 years, so it lasted a while. Later, Dorothea would claim that she and Johansson divorced in 1960, but records would show us that it really didn't happen until 1966.
So for some time after they separated, Dorothea continued to use her husband's surname. Some knew her as Sharon Johansson. Now, with this new name, she also created a new personality. Nothing wild or criminal about this Sharon Johansson, just the opposite. She's an active church member. She knew all the needy families in her neighborhood. With just a phone call, she directed food baskets and secondhand clothes to their homes. During this time, Mrs. Johansson established a great reputation as a caregiver. For several young girls, her home was a sanctuary from poverty and abuse. She welcomed hungry children and unwed mothers to her table, dishing out hot meals and free advice, and she eventually settled in Sacramento. So she would live there at various addresses and using various names, almost without interruption until 1988.
So she did seem to try and do some good things?
Yeah, at least at the beginning.
Yeah.
Although maybe that was all part of the scheme.
I don't know, because even towards the end when she was a serial killer, she seemed to justify it to herself, thinking that she did good things with the money. And maybe she felt these people, their lives just weren't worth living to her. She had a lot of justifications that were really sick.
Yes, that's for sure.
Yep. Well, in 1968, she'd been divorced a couple years. She's 39, and she married a much younger man, 23-year-old Roberto Jose Puente. This third marriage may have been the first time Dorothea was the one being used. Some said that Roberto married her for her money and American citizenship. They'd barely settled into their new Sacramento home when neighbors began hearing them screaming and throwing things, and after just 16 and a half months, they separated. Charging that young Roberto had treated her with extreme cruelty and had wrongfully inflicted grievous mental and physical suffering, Dorothea filed for divorce. She wanted the house in a 1967 four-door Ford Galaxy, but Roberto took off for his native Mexico, thwarting her attempts to have him served with divorce papers. In 1974, he came back, and attempts to rekindle the relationship didn't go very well. In January of 1975, Roberto refused to move out or pay her any rent, so that's when she filed a restraining order against him.
This was a tempestuous relationship, wasn't it?
At best, yes.
Yeah. So despite the difficulties between the two, Dorothea continued to use Roberto's surname. Now, Dorothea Puente ran a Sacramento halfway house for alcoholics. Following this, she shifted her attention to running a huge, elegant three-story boarding house at 21st and F Streets. This was the white mansion that she would boast about for years. She furnished the house with furniture donated from the Seventh-day Adventist Church and kept it spotless. Even her tenants, pretty much down-and-out alcoholics and homeless mentally ill, were kept clean and tidy, so everyone considered her a wonderful resource for the community. Dorothea networked with all the agencies. She had AA meetings in her parlor. She steered the indigent towards Social Security benefits and away from alcohol. In the words of one person who knew her at the time, Dorothea knew how to get things done.
So she was a smart person. Very clever. Devious.
Devious is a good adjective.
Yeah.
I think when we read about the fantastic lies she came up with, there had to be some basic intelligence behind all that.
Right.
Right?
Well, and just imagine the kind of confidence it takes to try and pull that off. I mean...
No kidding.
Almost to the point of craziness, I guess.
My father's Egyptian. My mother's Israeli. I'm a Muslim. Wow.
Yeah. She was always learning, especially when Dr. Carl Drake came by once a month to the boarding house to look after her renters. Dr. Drake found it convenient to make his diagnoses in the kitchen, and he'd write out prescriptions at her table. Dorothea would sit close by watching, and she kind of took over the medication management for her residents. Each day, she'd dole out each tenant's pills in little Dixie cups. And it seems like this kind of power really kind of overcame her, and she started medicating them kind of willy-nilly however she wanted. Like if someone's being a pain in the ass, she's just going to give them a little extra antidepressant or whatever would make them sleepy.
Right.
But she was polite to Dr. Drake.
Yeah, but maybe less polite to some of the boarders.
Well, she had a temper.
Yes, she did. She became widely known in Sacramento's Hispanic community as a Mexican-American philanthropist, even though she's not Mexican. Right. But that was the facade she presented.
She did.
So this identity supported her as a socially active member of the Hispanic community. And she befriended a charismatic man named Francisco Suarez, and she helped him start his weekly Spanish-language newspaper, La Semana News. Soon she was seen at Mexican-American fundraisers and having her picture taken for the paper. She did pick up some Spanish, she spent a lot of money, and she became known as La Doctora.
So kind of powerful at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of the height of her fame.
I don't know if I'd call it fame, but...
Well, this is the point where she's very well regarded in the community.
Yeah, maybe local fame, yeah.
And she's doing what sounds like good work.
It does, yeah. At 47, she set her sights on husband number 4. She was sweet on one of her tenants, and this was a handsome 51-year-old laborer from Puerto Rico named Pedro Angel Montalvo. Some of these names are just musical. I like them. She told him that she fell in love with him as soon as she saw him, and they got married in 1976 in Reno.
Number 4. Now, speaking of marriage, let's talk about weddings and wedding planning, because our sponsor today is Zola, the wedding company that will do anything for love.
Sure. Zola's really reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. Zola has everything you love about your favorite department store, plus cool new things like honeymoon funds, fitness classes, wine subscriptions, and so much more. Zola has over 500 brands and 50,000 gifts, experiences, and funds, and it's easy to use. They have a top-rated app for iPhone, iPad, and even your Apple Watch. For the less tech-savvy relatives and guests, they have a very friendly customer service team who's happy to walk Grandma and Aunt Lorraine through the registry process.
Over 300,000 couples have used Zola so far, easily managing their registries from wherever they are. Best of all, your Zola registry automatically integrates into your Zola wedding website, which allows guests to seamlessly shop and get all your wedding details in one place.
It's a brilliant idea.
It is. So our niece is getting married in the spring, and we were lucky enough to use their Zola wedding website to see pictures and plans and to purchase her shower gift. It was easy to navigate, and the selection was amazing.
Having their wedding site and their registry so seamlessly intertwined really gave me the whole vibe of Melinda and Nate as a couple and made me excited for their wedding. I was able to really pick and choose what I wanted to give, so I bought them some wine glasses, but then I was also able to contribute to their honeymoon expenses. Because you can kind of pick and choose. That's the great part of it. To sign up for Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, go to zola.com/brewery. That's Zola, ZOLA.com/brewery to sign up for a $50 credit towards your registry.
I'm back to Dorothea, the marrying woman. So on her marriage license for this fourth marriage, Dorothea listed her mother's maiden name as Puente. She also claimed that this was her second marriage. Now, a couple lies there, huh?
Yeah.
So Pedro, husband number four, started feeling uncomfortable with his new wife very quickly, within weeks as a matter of fact. She spent money as soon as it came in, and she lied every day. She had told Pedro that she was a doctor who owned land in Mexico, but she had never gone to college, and she didn't even speak Spanish. She knew a few words here and there.
So that's bold lying.
Sure is. I mean, I'm assuming that Pedro, with his surname, is Hispanic. He would pick up pretty quickly that she wasn't.
Well, yeah, I would think so. It seems like it's easier to lie to people when you're just in a social situation, but then once you're married to someone, I mean, Pedro's from Puerto Rico, so he would know.
Yeah, one would think.
It'd be hard to fool him.
Yeah, well, she didn't.
But they did have this kind of off and on passionate relationship. It only lasted a year. Afterwards, she said she was through with marriage. She'd have boyfriends now and then, but she wanted to be on her own. She was taking benefit checks that came in the mail for her tenants. She was forging their signatures, signing the checks over to herself, and then depositing the money into her account.
I don't think you're supposed to do that, are you?
No, and I'm not sure where it was going. I mean, she would claim it was to take care of people. But obviously there was some selfishness and misuse there.
Yeah, but she was still actually taking care of people.
Yeah. Well, toward the end of 1978, she was caught and she was convicted for these crimes, apparently cashing 34 federal checks illegally. Her sentence was relatively light, 5 years probation and $4,000 restitution.
So we're up to the early 80s now. Late 1981, Dorothea entered one of her favorite bars, a place with a rounded exterior topped with a neon cocktail glass called the Round Corner Tavern. Inside, she met Harold Monroe and Harold's new wife, Ruth. Now, they seemed to be a nice couple, and they invited Dorothea to join them, and she and Ruth got talking. Ruth was 61. She'd been out of work since leaving her job at a pharmacy, and she was ready to try something new. The owner of the Round Tavern was interested in leasing out the restaurant section. Ruth wanted a partner to run a restaurant there with her. So if they leased the restaurant, she and Dorothea would have minimal startup costs.
So this is not a good person to get into business with, and Ruth wasn't very cautious about it at all.
You go into a bar and you meet this couple and you're immediately planning on becoming partners in a restaurant?
Yeah, but I think that Dorothea must have been very convincing. She was a con woman.
Well,
because a lot of people fell for it.
That's true.
So it's hard to say with people like that. They seem like they're able to convince people of pretty much anything. Dorothea said that this was a great idea. And she said that Ruth wouldn't have to cook. She would handle the kitchen.
Yeah, well, why not?
That sounds like a good deal.
She's cooked for her boarders for years.
Right.
So she knows how to do that.
Mm-hmm. But Ruth was the one with the car, so she'd go out and handle the supply runs. The thing was that Ruth had to keep withdrawing the money for her share of the investment and handing it over to Dorothea. And they're in this exciting business, but Dorothea's not really contributing any money. She did work hard. She worked in the kitchen there just about every day. And she was cooking more than just hamburgers.
Yeah, she's cooking the books.
Right. She's robbing Ruth blind, really. The restaurant business was faltering, she told Ruth. And she just kept telling her she needed more capital to keep the business going. And Ruth kept giving her more and more money, either for the business or even personal expenses. But the bills are coming in and she's not really paying them. She's complaining to Ruth. So eventually, thousands of dollars of Ruth's money is just gone with nothing to show for it. Because they're leasing the building.
Right.
So she really doesn't own anything for her money.
Nope, they're not getting anything in return.
No.
In early 1982, Ruth's husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer. Now, he had to stay in a hospital, and Ruth was living alone. Now, in Ruth's great time of need, her friend Dorothea made a very generous offer. One of the boarders was moving out, Dorothea said, so why don't you just move in with me in the boarding house? It'd be less expensive than staying in that big house all by yourself. So Ruth moved in.
Bad, bad thing.
Well, it turns out to be a bad choice, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I guess Ruth's children weren't that involved if they weren't noticing all that was happening here.
No, it doesn't sound like it.
Now, when they did come to visit, which wasn't often, they were startled to find that their mother, who didn't drink, would have a glass of cream de mint in her hand. And she'd say to her kids, "Well, Dorothea gave this to me to calm my nerves." And she also looked kind of tired and pale, but Dorothea would just kind of usher them out of the house, assuring them that she was taking care of her. And she said, "You know, I used to be a nurse after all, so just trust me."
There's a new occupation.
Yeah, she used that one quite often because she'd been like a nurse's aide, a caretaker.
Right.
So she'd just say she was a nurse or a doctor.
That's probably better or more plausible than calling yourself a doctor.
Well, I guess, but a lot of people believed it, so she must have been well-spoken and able to pull it off.
Oh, I think she's a great con person.
Yes. Her reputation in the boarding house was very mixed, though. Some tenants said she was stingy, and they complained that she refused to give them their mail or their money. But there were others who praised her because she was very kind and generous. She made great homemade meals and seemed like she really cared about them. In April of 1982, Ruth died from an overdose of codeine and Tylenol. And Dorothea would tell police that Ruth was very depressed because her husband was terminally ill. And they believed her. And this death ended up being recorded as a suicide.
So a few weeks later, the police were back visiting Dorothea after her 74-year-old tenant, Malcolm McKenzie, accused her of drugging and stealing from him. So in August of 1982... she is convicted of 3 charges of theft and was sentenced to 5 years in jail. Now, when she was in jail, she began corresponding with a 77-year-old retiree living in Oregon named Everson Gilmouth. So I guess it's not just women writing to men in jail. Sometimes it's men writing to women in jail.
Yeah, I guess so.
A pen pal friendship developed, and when she was released in 1985 after serving 3 years of her sentence, Everson was waiting for her. The relationship developed quickly, and they soon made plans to be married.
So much for her claiming that she's done with marriage.
That's right.
Right?
Well, I don't think they ever got married, though, did they?
Things happen so quickly with her, you know?
Yeah.
Just all of a sudden, you meet her, and you're marrying her, you're moving in with her.
I know.
She's very slick.
So Dorothea and Everson opened a joint bank account, and they paid $600 a month rent for the upstairs apartment at 1426 F Street in Sacramento.
You know, late that year, Dorothea hired handyman Ismael Flores to install some wood paneling in her apartment. For his labor and an additional $800, she gave him a red 1980 Ford pickup in good condition, which she said belonged to her boyfriend in L.A. who no longer needed it. So this is Gilmouth's truck.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
She asked Flores to build a box 6 feet by 3 feet by 2 feet to store some books and other items in. So this is super suspicious. Then she asked Flores to transport the filled and nailed shut box to a storage depot. So this guy's either super naive or she's just so convincing. But why would you need a nailed shut box?
You got me. I'm thinking he's just kind of stupid.
I don't know. I mean, there must have been an odor, too.
Yeah.
But he agreed, and she joined him on the trip. But on the way, she has him stop and pull over on the Garden Highway in Sutter County and dump the box on the riverbank. So this was kind of an unofficial household dumping site where people would drop off old refrigerators and stuff like that. And he did ask her about the contents, I guess, but she said it was just junk. And on second thought, I don't need it. Let's just dump it. Which makes no sense if you have him build the box specially and then drive off and say, "Oh, let's just dump it here because I've decided I don't want it."
Yeah, I know.
It's so suspicious.
But he complied.
He did. And, I mean, he must have known something was up, right?
I got to think he was complicit.
Yeah, at least somewhat. Maybe just, you know, for the truck and the money, he was willing to not think about it or not look into it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So in January 1st, actually, New Year's Day, 1986, a fisherman found the box sitting about 3 feet from the bank of the river, and he called police. Investigators found the decomposed and unidentifiable body of an elderly man inside. Meanwhile, Dorothea is continuing to collect Everson Gilmouth's pension and she was writing letters to his family explaining that the reason he had not contacted them was because he was ill. She continued to maintain a room and board business, taking in 40 new tenants.
Now, it wasn't that big of a house.
No.
So some of these tenants weren't living very long.
No.
Is that right?
Right.
This is starting to happen.
There's some turnover here.
Yes, which people don't know about. So she's collecting more checks than there are live people there.
Right. And you would think that she's already been busted for this once. Maybe the second time you'd have a little more thoughts about it.
For the check stealing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she continued.
Well, I think she probably figured, well, I can't steal checks from people who are still alive because they'll say something. So if I kill them, I'll get away with it, which did work for a while.
It did for a time.
And Gilmoth's body wasn't identified for another 3 years. So even though they found the body, she didn't get in trouble.
She had 3 years of his checks.
Yeah, right. And other people's checks, right?
Yeah.
Because she's continuing to take in these tenants, and she was becoming more and more popular with local social workers because she was the rare person who was willing to accept some tough cases, including drug addicts and tenants who'd been physically abusive. Now, she would go and collect their monthly mail before they saw it, and she would pay them stipends. So she'd give them an allowance for their expenses, and she'd take the rest. During this period, parole agents went and visited her. Now, she'd been ordered to stay away from the elderly and to stop handling government checks. But for some reason, I am not able to figure out. There were no violations ever reported on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe not mind-boggling, but it's just a curious thing.
Well, I just wonder if it's this whole grandma persona that she played so well.
Yeah, that's an idea.
People aren't going to be suspicious of her.
She's a sweet little Grammy type.
Right, exactly.
Little old white-haired grandma.
I know. She pretended to be older than she actually was. And I think that was all part of the con.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, back when she did that other boarding house, she was kind of a big, heavy lady with dark hair. And then now she was this tiny little gray-haired lady.
That's right.
So someone did connect her to, was it Sharon Johansson, the name she went under at the other boarding house?
Yes.
And there was a social worker who was making that connection, that she was the same person, but other people weren't really believing that.
They didn't listen to her.
No. But she knew that this woman, this Johansson woman, had been stealing money at least.
Mm-hmm.
But other people, I think they just wanted a place to take these people that was hard to find a place for.
And she was, after all, providing a service.
Right, exactly.
One of Dorothea's tenants was a guy named John Sharp. Now, unlike many of the other tenants, his vice was poker, not liquor. He didn't have much in common with the drinkers of the house. He liked to stand outside and converse with Ben Fink and Ben's younger brother, Robert, who often visited Ben there. Now, Ben wasn't a bad guy. He never really bothered anybody. And though his room was just a thin wall away, Sharp didn't spend much time with him. He knew Ben was a heavy drinker, and he could hear him coming and going. Each month, after he got his benefit check, Ben would go on a major drinking binge until the money ran out.
Which is a pretty normal pattern in that situation, I think.
It is.
But in spring of 1988, things did change. John heard Ben Fink come to the back door, and he heard him fumbling with his keys. John's door was open, and he saw a bleary-eyed Ben staggering with his hand wrapped around a bottle in a paper bag. That wasn't super unusual. A minute later, though, his door closed, and John heard Ben kind of fall onto his bed, as he did most nights, and kind of pass out or go to sleep. John forgot about Ben until later that evening, when he bumped into Dorothea in the hall. Dorothea told him that Ben needed some sobering up, and she was going to take him upstairs and make him feel better. So that is ominous.
Well, in hindsight it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although after that, after Dorothea took him upstairs, John Sharp didn't hear or see Ben Fink around anymore. Room next door was vacant and quiet. So about 4 days later, John climbed the back stairs to use the telephone, and when he walked past the spare bedroom near the kitchen, he was hit by a distinct and sickening odor. He remembered years before when he'd worked at a mortuary, it was the smell of death. So now Ben Fink's disappearance took on a totally different meaning.
Sure did.
For hours afterwards, John was debating what to do. Should he confront Dorothea? Should he call the authorities?
Well, I would call the authorities.
Yeah, I wouldn't confront Dorothea because she's the one that caused this, probably.
No, I think I tried to anonymously contact the authorities, but he was worried.
Yeah, because what if he was wrong? He knew how angry Dorothea could be, and he didn't want to end up back on the streets.
Yeah, that's kind of selfish, but I can kind of see where he's coming from there.
For sure.
Now, Dorothea began to complain about the smell herself. She told John that the sewer had backed up. She worried that she didn't know how to get the smell out of the house, and she said it ruined the carpet. She acted like she was, you know, worried, which she probably was, about getting rid of that smell. She said, "I just don't know what to do." She rented a rug shampooer, but even repeatedly shampooing didn't help. Now, John thought that she probably shampooed that carpet at least a dozen times before she finally had workers tear that carpet out. When another tenant named Bert disappeared, his social worker came looking for him. Now, Bert was a schizophrenic, and he was mildly retarded. The social worker visited him from time to time and was happy that he was showing great improvements since he'd moved in with Dorothea in the boarding house. When Dorothea told her that Bert had gone on a trip to Mexico with her and he'd decided to stay a while with her family outside of Guatemala, the social worker became very worried and suspicious. This just didn't seem like something Bert would do. He's not a social person.
No, he wouldn't say, "I'm going to stay down here and visit family and stuff like that."
No. So she's continuing to call the boarding house weekly, and Dorothea kept putting her off. Now, eventually, a strange man would call up the social worker and told her he was Bert's brother-in-law in Utah and that he'd gone to the boarding house and picked up Bert after he returned from Mexico. He said that Bert was with him, and Bert didn't want to speak to her. And he wouldn't leave a phone number and address, so there really isn't much the social worker can do about that.
No, there isn't. So suspicion is even more aroused when neighbors notice the odd activities of a homeless alcoholic known only as Chief. Now, Dorothea said she had adopted Chief as her personal handyman. She had Chief dig in the basement and cart soil and rubbish away in a wheelbarrow. At the time, the basement floor was covered with a concrete slab. Chief also took down a garage in the backyard and installed a fresh concrete slab there as well. And then mysteriously soon afterwards, Chief disappeared.
So, the thing about this is, she didn't even own this house, right? She was renting.
That's what we're told, but she's doing an awful lot of work on it.
She's doing these major renovations and digging, and then Chief, the main guy who's doing it, just disappears.
Right.
Very suspicious.
Well, we're starting to see kind of a pattern of boarders disappearing.
Yeah, but it's just taking so long for anyone to notice because these are kind of the remnants of society.
These are marginal people.
Yeah.
So you're not necessarily going to notice that they've disappeared.
Right. She's really preying on the most vulnerable people there are.
Right. So in November 1988, things begin to unravel. Police are looking for a tenant, one of Dorothea's tenants, Alvaro Montoya, who had disappeared. Alvaro was a developmentally disabled schizophrenic whose social worker had reported him missing. So there, police are investigating. They see some disturbed soil on Dorothea's property. They ask her permission. She says, "Okay, you can search."
Mm-hmm.
They dig up a body.
It turned out to
be a woman, Leona Carpenter, who I don't think we've heard of yet.
No.
And initially, obviously, she wasn't identified. So they've dug up a body of a female.
Yes.
And here's the interesting thing. So they come back because they found a body in the backyard. And
yeah.
There's all these concrete slabs and stuff. They're going to be digging up the backyard.
Jeez, I know.
So Dorothea, for some reason, was not immediately a suspect. And she was allowed to leave the property. She told investigators that she wanted to go buy a cup of coffee at a nearby hotel. And they said, "Sure, go ahead." In fact, one of them was going to continue watching this food that was cooking on the stove for her.
I know, right? So the police, they really get a lot of backlash from this.
Yeah,
this was so stupid.
Because Dorothea left the house and fled immediately to Los Angeles. Boom, she's gone.
She's probably thinking, "I can't believe they let me leave after they found a body."
Yeah.
She already has a criminal history.
She does.
A forensic anthropologist was called in to supervise the excavation of bodies in the back corner of Dorothea's yard. So Dr. Hegler, a very practiced eye, identifies areas where slight changes in the color and texture of the soil indicated recent digging. Plants had been uprooted, and here and there topsoil had been removed. He scooped dirt away from patches of fabric. Now crouched at the base of a newly planted tree, he was using a metal probe, testing the surrounding area for resistance. Then he would begin flicking away little pieces of soil with his brush. He enlisted the help of a coroner's investigator and some others, and this spot became their focus. With shovels, they scooped earth away, and then they would use small hand trowels when they got closer and they got down to the more meticulous things. They ended up finding 6 more bodies, and they had all been wrapped in layers of material before burial. So at first, they're finding little pieces of fabric. They found these little pieces that looked like leather, which would end up being flesh that had come off of the bodies.
Because they were all pretty mummified.
Yeah, different degrees of decomposition, right? But they were all wrapped. Now, they didn't tamper with them at the site. With protocol, they were tagged, photographed, and sealed in white plastic body bags and taken to the morgue for autopsy. Police found it really hard to imagine that little old Dorothea Puente maneuvered these dead bodies into the ground by herself. We're making the assumption that it would be pretty hard for a woman of her small size to carry these bodies, Lieutenant Enlow said to the press. So with Dorothea on the run, finding an accomplice became one of their top priorities. When Dorothea's tenant, John McCauley, arrived back at the house, he was first confronted by reporters. He loyally defended his landlady. He said, "She's helped people out. She's taking them in. She has let them stay there for a couple of days without even paying." But soon police learned that McCauley had returned, and they challenged him, demanding to know, "Where is Dorothea?" Now, he claimed that he didn't know. He said that she was probably still at the Clarion Hotel. So the police rushed over to search, but of course she wasn't there. In the meantime, she allegedly had phoned McCauley and told him to run. Police arrested the 59-year-old McCauley, though, as an accessory to homicide. And they felt happy, well, at least we've arrested somebody because we are going to get a ration of shit for letting her go.
And they did.
They certainly did.
So many people were demanding to know whether Bert Montoya's body had been one of those retrieved from the yard.
Yeah, he had a social worker that really cared about him.
He did.
And was bringing it up all the time.
Now, there wasn't much said about the news that the coroner's office was trying to match the 7 remains with as many as 25 former tenants. Again, these are people on the outskirts of society, so it's tough to keep track of their comings and goings. So except for a few murmurings of concern, there's a strange silence regarding the identities of most of the others. It's as if no families remained behind to miss them and to demand answers. These people died unwanted and unloved.
It's really tragic. So who were these 7 people, and why did they die? The coroner's office was proceeding with their inquiry. The autopsies of the badly decomposed bodies filled the air there with a putrid odor, and I just can't imagine the work they had to do identifying these victims.
Oh.
I mean, they worked in shifts.
You'd have to.
The 2 forensic pathologists had to cut, weigh, and observe for clues every little bit of these bodies. The disintegrating clothes suggested whether a body was male or female, because otherwise they couldn't tell. The bones of the feet were sometimes inside the shoes, and they were overtaken with insect larvae. But the laces would still be tied in bows, which made kind of a certain irony there.
Yes, isn't it?
Dr. Anthony found one corpse so mummified that it resembled a large parchment-like mass of beef jerky, were his words. That's a horrible image.
It is.
With such advanced decomposition, he couldn't find much soft tissue. The internal organs, individually unidentifiable, were removed as a solid mass. But they did manage to send some tissue samples of the brains off for toxicology tests.
And Dr. Anthony autopsied a white male adult who was wrapped in sheets of plastic and sealed with duct tape. He was clad in dark short pants, boxer shorts, and dark socks. He had been about 5'8" tall, 40 to 60 years old, brown hair, brown eyes, a mustache, and no teeth. Criminalists live by the rule that criminals always leave behind a calling card. A rapist's pubic hair, a shooter's bullet, a burglar's footprint. During this slow, meticulous work on the autopsy table, there is a signature for Dorothy's victim being identified. Each of the bodies had been wrapped and buried in essentially the same way. Materials might differ, but the manner of burial, the knots, the duct tape, the twine, left little question that they were all the handiwork of the same person. As an example, the fifth body was wrapped in layers of fabric secured with red string. The sixth was wrapped in fabric and paper and tied with twine. One was an adult male, the other female, might not have even known each other in life. Might not have even known each other in life, but in death their fates were identical. In a sleeveless flowered nightgown, a female was also badly decomposed. But this body also had her head, hands, and feet missing.
So that was a little bit different.
That was.
The three men and four women who had been dug up from the yard shared this macabre kinship in the way they were disposed of. Wrapped in plastic and cloth, each body had been rotting in anonymity for quite a long time, anywhere from weeks to months to even a couple of years. But there were few clues to what had actually killed them. There was no evidence of hemorrhaging, no wounds, no trauma, no signs of violence. In every case, the cause of death remained undetermined. So this is bad news for law enforcement. It's really hard to prove someone was murdered when there's no evidence of how they actually died. Without a cause of death, it was possible that Dorothea might get away with some of these serial murders, if not all of them.
That's a very strong possibility.
Police detectives then met with Social Security officials, tracking down payments made to the tenants at 1426 F Street. They began searching Puente's bank accounts, and then they were able to track the money trail. Meanwhile, video equipment was taken along in their searches of the boarding house. Police found an assortment of paperwork, including information regarding funeral plots, photographs, mail, and correspondence that they believed could aid in identifying the bodies and in determining her motive. They also confiscated duct tape, a blue tarp, and some sections of blood-stained carpet. It had been 3 years since police had investigated a makeshift coffin on the riverbank. Remember that a few years ago.
We've got this unidentified body.
Yeah, so homicide detectives are really intrigued when they read the reports coming out of Sacramento about Dorothea Puente's yard. Sutter County Deputy Lieutenant Wilbur Terry was listening to the news, and his ears perked up when he heard about this, because some of these details seemed awfully familiar to him.
Yeah, so he retrieved the old case file on this unidentified body. The body was wrapped in bedsheets and plastic, seemed like the work of the same person, compared with what was happening in Dorothea's backyard.
Exactly.
Soon the Sacramento police and the Sutter County deputies were comparing notes. The Sacramento police supplied a list of missing persons, and the Sutter County department set about looking for a match. One name did catch their attention, Everson Gilmouth. The time of his disappearance and his overall description fit. Now, a positive ID would take some effort, so they had to track down family members and obtain medical records. There's a search for existing fingerprints, which turned up nothing, because Gilmouth's military records had been destroyed in a fire. And the Department of Motor Vehicles in Oregon, unlike California, did not register fingerprints.
I didn't know that any Department of Motor Vehicles registered fingerprints. I've never had to do that.
Now, eventually, they were able to accumulate enough for an identification. X-rays showed that, like the corpse in the box, Everson Gilmouth had lost the tip of his right thumb. Reba Nicholas came down from Sweet Home, Oregon. This is Everson's sister. She knew for certain that it was her brother who was dead. Though he hadn't been unearthed from Puente's yard, as she suspected back in November when she'd phoned the Sacramento police, but she was more convinced than ever that her brother had been killed by Dorothea. She told the reporters Everson said that Dorothea would take care of him. Well, she did.
She certainly did. Sacramento police ran Everson through their computers, and the DMV files did have a lead. Though Gilmouth's body had been found on January 1, 1986, records showed that his red Ford truck had been sold in July 1987. So the name on the bill of sale was Ismael Flores.
There we are.
A big breakthrough.
It is.
Now, two detectives went to question him, and he seemed very nervous. He admitted he knew Dorothea Puente. He'd once done some paneling at her house, he said. He even admitted that he'd bought the Ford truck from her, but he claimed to know nothing about Everson Gilmouth. But finally, it did come out that Dorothea had once hired him to build this large wooden box. Police arrested him on charges of being an accessory to murder. It was almost a fluke that 46-year-old Flores was apprehended as Dorothea Puente's accomplice. The trail connecting him to her was cold and it had been nearly forgotten. Still, no one was claiming that he had helped her bury anyone. His involvement didn't leak him to the 7 bodies in her yard at all, but it did rise the body count to 8. Now, reporters and television crews swarmed the courthouse as Flores was arraigned, and the media reported that Puente's assistant had been arrested. They had evidence and witnesses who saw the box being taken out of her house and saw him driving away in the pickup with the box. So that was helpful.
That was. So Dorothea, remember, had been on the lam.
Yes.
She ended up in Los Angeles, and she's staying in a hotel under the name Donna Johansson.
Now, isn't that funny how she uses a name that was actually real? Why wouldn't she use a totally different name that there's no connection?
Because we've seen in previous times she could make up names easily.
Right. So it's kind of funny that she used that name.
Yep. So one day she dressed up and took a cab to a bar, wanted to drink a little bit.
Well, she'd been holed up in that hotel room for a while.
She's going crazy.
I think so.
In the bar, she met a man named Chuck Wilgues. He was a retired handyman. Now, he shared a few details of his life with Dorothea. No family nearby, few medical problems, quiet lifestyle, and a fixed income. Donna seemed to take a genuine interest in his problems. She even suggested that she could help him increase his Social Security benefits, somehow seeming to know exactly how much disability he should receive for his back problems, tuberculosis, ulcer, and hernia.
Well, she's very experienced in making the most of these payments.
Yeah. So Chuck's initially pretty excited about this, but he gets back to his house or his apartment, and he's starting to feel a little bit uncomfortable. While he was initially flattered by her attention, he saw on the TV news that she resembled the person that they were looking for in Sacramento.
And I think she seemed just a little too interested in his disability, a little too knowledgeable to be normal.
I think so.
And maybe that perked up his attention, but I think he really didn't want to believe it was her.
He didn't, because he wanted to believe that she was really going to help him.
Yeah.
But now, and I'm not sure what this whole thing is about, but Chuck was afraid to call the police or confront Dorothy. So he ended up calling the Los Angeles Bureau of CBS. And this was a guy named Gene Silver, who was the news assignment editor.
Yeah, so he talked with Chuck on the phone for a while, and Gene began to think that the sighting was actually for real. He went to Chuck's apartment, bringing with him photos of Dorothea to have him confirm her identity as the woman he'd met in the bar. So after that, Chuck was pretty sure it was her. He wouldn't say 100%, but he did say he'd made plans to meet her again the next day. So Gene Silver, he gathered up a camera crew, and he made a call to the police. Now, detectives soon arrived at Chuck Wilgues' apartment. He told them what he knew, yet he was still unable to believe that this charming, very ladylike, he called her, friend could be Dorothea. He even asked that they delay the arrest of her for just one day because he had this date with her, and he said he wanted to keep the date.
That's fun. But police didn't want to wait that long because they thought they might lose her again.
Well, I would hope so. They've already blown it once.
No kidding. So they knocked on her door at a little after 10 o'clock that night when she looks outside and sees the officers and a camera crew. So Dorothea stalled. She identified herself as Donna Johansson. But when police asked for proper identification, a driver's license in her handbag revealed the name Dorothea Montalvo, and her address is 1426 F Street in Sacramento. So she's handcuffed, and she's wearing the same pink dress and red coat that she'd worn in her flight from Sacramento. And she got taken into the patrol car. So we're going to send her back to Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
So before he loaded a frail-looking Dorothea Montalvo Puente into the waiting plane at Hollywood Burbank Airport, Sacramento Police Sergeant Jim Jorgensen turned to reporters and said, "In 23 years of law enforcement, I've found that nothing is beyond the realm of believability when you're dealing with human beings."
Yeah. During the flight, she sipped coffee, and she did submit to a short interview.
Yeah, this is another interesting story.
Yeah.
I guess the Sacramento police are trying to figure out a way to get down to Los Angeles to pick her up, and the news station chartered a jet. So So the police are going down to pick up Dorothea, as well as news people.
Right.
That just boggles the mind.
It is unusual, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she was questioned, right?
Yeah, but not by police.
No.
She wasn't given her Miranda rights or anything like that.
So she was questioned by a reporter named Mike Boyd, and she softly admitted, "I cashed checks, yes," but she maintained, "I have not killed anyone." But she did make the statement, "I used to be a very good person at one time." A few hours later, Dorothea was booked into the Sacramento County Jail. Police took her purple leather purse that contained a wallet, a California driver's license, a watch, a notepad, and some stamps. She also had some cologne in there and other cosmetics. She also had a sealed plastic envelope that contained over $3,000. So she traded that nice red coat and pink dress for an orange jumpsuit that said Sacramento County Jail across her back. Now later that morning, looking tired, pale, and kind of confused, she was brought into a packed courtroom in front of Judge John V. Stroud. She looked vulnerable and small, standing next to assistant public defenders that were assigned to her, Peter Vaughtlin and Kevin Climo. Her trial was moved to Monterey County, California, on a change of venue motion filed by Climo and Vaughtlin. The actual trial began in October of 1992, and it ended about a year later. The prosecutor, John O'Mara, was the homicide supervisor in the Sacramento County District Attorney's office, and he called over 130 witnesses.
O'Mara argued to the jury that Dorothea had used sleeping pills to put her tenants to sleep and then suffocated them and hired convicts to dig the holes in her yard.
Well, they did find quite a bit of medication when they searched the boarding house.
There was.
Yeah.
A lot of Dalmane, an old time
That is a sedative, major, hypnotic. Major sedative.
Yeah.
I remember once I cut my eye on a piece of wallpaper and I went to the ER and the doctor gave me one Dalmane pill and said, take that tonight so you'll be able to sleep.
And did you sleep?
No, because I actually dropped it behind the stove in the kitchen and I never got to take it. But he told me this will just knock you out for the night. Anyway, just a little interesting story. I've just always believed Dalmane is like super serious sedative.
It is, and it's not made anymore.
No.
So.
Yeah, a lot of those good drugs just aren't made anymore, are they?
So the jury deliberated over a month and found Puente guilty of 3 murders. They could not agree on the others. Now, the penalty phase of the prosecution was highlighted by her prior convictions.
The defense called several witnesses that showed that she had a generous and caring side to her. Mental health experts testified about her abusive childhood and how that had motivated her to help the less fortunate, which is something that she did. At the same time, they agreed she had an evil side brought on by the stress of caring for her down-and-out tenants. So I don't know why that would be brought on by stress to be evil. To me,
yeah,
that's a stretch. That's not something that's legitimately connected in my mind.
No, but they're doing their job.
Oh, sure. They need to do that. But I'm just not buying it.
Nope, you're not.
No.
So O'Mara's closing argument ended with, "Does anyone become responsible for their conduct in this world?" These people were human beings. They had a right to live. They did not have a lot of possessions, no houses, no cars, only their social security checks and their lives. She took it all. Death is the only appropriate penalty.
Well, Kevin Climo, one of the defense attorneys, responded by focusing on Dorothea the child and Dorothea the caregiver. After several days of deliberating, the jury was deadlocked 7-5 for life. The judge, Michael J. Verga, declared a mistrial when the jury said further deliberations would not change their mind. Now, under the law, Puente received life without the possibility of parole. She was incarcerated at Central California Women's Facility in California, and for the rest of her life, she maintained her innocence, and she insisted that her tenants had all died of natural causes.
And she just buried the bodies?
I guess so.
Okay.
Now, if they had a mistrial, how does that work?
Well, the mistrial was on the sentencing phase, and they couldn't agree on a death sentence.
I see.
So that's all that was.
So then the judge just decides if that happens?
Well, under the law, she was convicted of murder, mm-hmm. so she received the sentence of life without parole.
So you just can't give death without it being unanimous. It defaults to life in prison?
It certainly does.
Okay. I don't think a lot of people wanted to put her to death. Hard to do to this little old grandma, even though she was super evil.
Yeah, but I mean, how old? She was 60 at the time.
Yeah, she was claiming to be like 80. She was 59. She claimed to be in her 70s or something like that.
Yeah, so I can probably see why you don't want to vote for death for an elderly person like that.
Yeah, but why? Just because she'll die soon?
Yeah.
And well, you figure... that's not really a reason.
We'll just put her in prison for the rest of her life.
Well, I would think that way anyway, because I don't agree with the death penalty, really. It doesn't seem to do any good, but...
And when did she die?
She died in 2011 in prison. She was 82, and it was from natural causes. She wasn't shanked or anything.
Yeah.
Well, she probably had a pretty peaceful life in prison. Maybe they have like a... Don't they have like nursing home centers in the prison for elderly people?
Yeah, something.
I think they separate them.
She served like 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of her sentence.
Right.
Okay.
So she served a while and died.
Yep.
Now, a lot of the information we got for this podcast, we got from a book by Carla Norton. So I just like to give her credit. And her book is called Disturbed Ground, The True Story of a Diabolical Female Serial Killer. And if you're interested in finding out more about the case, I think that's a good place to look.
It's a very well-written book.
Yeah. Let's get right to feedback.
Okay. I have a couple responses to the most recent episode we did, Unleashed Rage, The Killing of Betty Gore. That's the story of Candy Montgomery, who chopped up her friend.
It's an incredible story.
It is.
Yeah, we had a lot of responses to it. We just picked out a couple.
So this first one is from Deanna. She says, like many listeners, I was stunned that a jury decided Candace Montgomery was acting in self-defense when she hacked Betty Gore to death with an axe. The fact that a 9-woman, 3-man jury of reasonable people decided the mother of 2 young children was not guilty of murder is just incomprehensible to me. After the podcast, I kept thinking, well, a convincing defense attorney and an incompetent prosecutor can get anyone off. And she references Casey Anthony and O.J. Simpson. Most of the people were following her comments. How could she have gotten off? One spectator, however, wasn't surprised by the verdict, which took the jury a little more than 3 hours to reach. Doris Howard of Denton County said she could understand the jury's thinking because the prosecution did a poor job. Now, the defense attorney, Crowder, said, we're just very pleased, very pleased. We're proud the jury had enough courage to stand up.
Yeah, I find that kind of funny.
It is. That's pretty much it.
Okay, so you're not reading the whole thing, I guess. You're just kind of perusing it. All right.
I'm perusing it. But then we have the follow-up, and I'm not sure we covered this. It concerns the defense attorney. This is from Sharon H. Sharon says, as a retired academic researcher, the researcher part of me never retires. Even when I listen to podcasts or watch true crimes, I know a lot about the presentation, and it always gives me more questions that I must have answers to. This was an unknown crime to me, so I'll spend days researching it, but I've already found something terribly sad but very interesting. Although not podcast-worthy, as there doesn't seem to be any mystery involved, the defense attorney's life and subsequent suicide in 1999, that was more sad to me than anything I heard in the podcast. And that's Don Crowder, who is married to his second wife, Sherry, had become increasingly depressed since the case. And I don't know, I was reading a little article, and there wasn't anything it talked about where this depression stemmed from.
I don't know. I kind of was thinking there was a lot of hate against him in the community for getting her off.
I think that's kind of between the lines.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was depressed. He was drinking heavily, and he had been recently arrested for DWI. So this was something that he just couldn't quite get over the shame of it. He had been hospitalized briefly for an overdose of prescription drugs and was discharged. His wife thought that he was going through some hard times, but they were going to get better because his daughter was due to have a baby pretty soon and make him a grandfather. But one night he got out of bed. She thought he was heading to the bathroom, but he didn't come back to bed. And she went to the bathroom. He wasn't there. Found him in the exercise room with the door locked. After some back and forth and talk, he shot himself and killed himself.
Wow. That's sad. It's also a horrible thing to do to his wife.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So those are a couple unhappy endings to the Candy Montgomery, Betty Gore story, because people think that Candy should have been found guilty, and even more unhappy for the defense attorney who took his own life.
Yes, because he was brilliant. As much as I think she should have gone to prison for that, that it was murder, he was brilliant the way he handled it. And I wouldn't hold it against him because that's his job.
Right.
That's what defense attorneys have to do. I don't think it's fair for anyone to blame him for getting a murderer off because that's the way our system works. You have to have someone on their side.
You have to have an advocate, right?
I'd be more upset with the prosecutor because I think the prosecutor failed to prove their case. They could have done a lot more. I think they just felt like it was easy and they were going to get her in prison easily.
And I think that in the cases that were referenced, the Casey Anthony case and the O.J. Simpson case, that's a familiar theme. The prosecution thought they had a slam dunk case.
I think so. Well, with O.J., there's all these societal and racial things mixed in as well. But I think that overconfidence is a problem with some of the prosecution.
I think so.
Because they were obvious. They should have gone to prison, obviously. To most of us, we believe that.
We do, fervently.
Yeah. I have a case suggestion from Filthy Lucre. The murder of Adrian Jones from Kansas is the worst story I've ever heard. Please consider covering this. So, I don't know why people want us to cover the worst thing they've ever heard.
I don't either.
But
this is bad.
This is really bad. This is Adrian's father, Michael Jones, was sentenced to life in prison with no chance for parole for 25 years in the death of his son, Adrian. Testimony showed that the child had been tortured, repeatedly beaten, and starved by the father and the child's stepmother, Heather Jones, and then his body was fed to pigs. So this is heinous. I don't know if we'll cover it or not, but I don't know. It looks like he's looking for a new trial.
Okay.
So we could look into it more. That's just a summary of it, but it is horrendous. And I don't know how someone's father, I don't get it. When it's someone's parent or something, that just to me is unbelievable. Also, for some reason, when it's a woman, I find that stunning that his stepmother would have anything to do with that. Although I know there are evil women out there, but
there's a lot of evil.
I know.
Your description, I don't think I'd have the stomach for doing that.
Yeah, it's just horrible. Well, it's another one of those horrible child abuse cases.
So I have a note from Nicole X about expectations, the disappearance of Kelsey Schelling. So this is the case of the woman in Colorado who found out she was pregnant, was driving from Denver to Pueblo to meet up with her boyfriend, Dante Lucas, and give him the happy news that she was pregnant, and she vanished.
I don't know how happy it was. It was unplanned.
Right. So Nicole X says they arrested Dante weeks ago. Now the lead detective says they're going forward with murder charges.
Yay.
So he certainly was a person of interest.
Yeah.
At the time of the crime.
Absolutely.
But they apparently didn't have enough to hold him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been free all this time from the last 4 years or so.
Well, I think he's been in jail for other things off and on.
He has.
Yeah.
They have arrested him and charged him.
Okay. Well, that's good news.
That is.
Yeah. Well, Cammie T. wrote me with a case suggestion to do the Scotty Baker story. The case is similar to Kyron Horman's story, she says. Scotty's stepmom was jealous of him for a long time because he had a really good relationship with his father. In 1992, the last day before Thanksgiving break, one of his mom's friends took Scotty out of school early around 11 a.m. and the stepmother strangled the boy while her friend was driving. And the stepmother who killed him was pregnant at this time. That's stunning.
So what did the woman driving the car do?
I've got a little more detail on it here. I looked up. Says the 10-year-old Scotty Baker was summoned to the office at his elementary school, and this was in a poor old mining town in Manchester, Kentucky. And the school secretary, Charlotte Smith, told the fifth grader that a woman had just come to pick him up. Scotty hesitated, not recognizing the woman, but he responded happily when she gently told him she was taking him to see his father. So here's a big question in my head, why this boy was sent with someone he didn't even know. I thought there was a list of people who were allowed to pick up a child.
There is.
Well, so that wasn't listened to. That wasn't followed, I guess. So moments later, they walked out to the parking lot together.
When did this happen?
1992.
25 years ago. Maybe they were a little more lax about
Maybe a little, but still thought you had to have permission. Anyway, they walked into the parking lot together and got into this woman's Buick. And what Scotty didn't know was that crouched in the back seat was his father's second wife, Stephanie Baker, who was 22. Minutes later, Scotty Baker was dead, strangled by his own stepmother. In the following October, Stephanie Baker was sentenced to life in prison for his murder. and the people of Manchester, which has a population of about 1,600, could only wonder at her brutality and her motive. Baker, who just 9 months before the murder had married Scotty's father, Donnie, apparently killed the boy out of jealousy. She wanted 100% of Donnie's attention, says State Police Detective Larry Lewis. She didn't want anyone else in the picture. She wanted Donnie all to herself. Those who thought they knew her had seen no hint of such a deadly potential. She grew up in London, Kentucky, about 25 miles west of Manchester. She sang in the choir at the community Christian church and spent 2 years at a nearby college where she studied psychology. She met truck driver Donnie Baker in August 1991. He was divorced from his ex-wife, Ruth. Donnie shared custody of 9-year-old Scotty. When he met Stephanie, he was smitten. He said she was really sweet, pretty, and went to church. And 6 months after they met, they married on Valentine's Day, 1992. And Scotty served as their ring bearer. To friends and neighbors, all seemed well. Stephanie, who worked at the Walmart in nearby London, often took Scotty to the store to pick out toys, and the two were sometimes seen playing ball in the yard together. She was as nice as she could be, recalls Dorothy Jackson, Donnie's mother. She seemed like a perfect person. Soon, though, Stephanie began feeling frustrated. Her husband's work frequently took him on the road for days at a time, and when he was home, he made it clear he wanted to spend as much time with his son as he could, and that didn't please his young bride. Now, she was 22, he was 35, so there was an age difference there. For his part, Scotty never said anything against Stephanie, and he never backtalked her. He was very aware that she was jealous, though. In July, Baker attempted suicide by slitting her wrists. She and Donnie separated and reconciled several times, but by autumn, the marriage was in trouble again. I believe she thought Scotty would always be first in my life, says Donnie. She couldn't stand it. It was about that time that Stephanie got together again with Suzanne Baker, who was no relation. That's her best friend from high school. During frequent shopping trips and get-togethers in the following weeks, the women, prosecutors say, began hatching a plot to murder the boy. About that time, she confided her resentment in her diary. I don't dislike Donnie's son, she wrote. I just want to be able to do whatever I want in my own home, and I don't particularly enjoy keeping doors shut and keeping fully dressed all the time. By November, she had discovered that she was pregnant, further complicating her already troubled marriage. On November 23rd, the Monday before Thanksgiving, she spoke by telephone with Donnie, who was on the road. When he said that he was planning to drive his truck to Tennessee after Thanksgiving, she told him that she wanted to come too. He told her that sounded fine, but he had already promised to take Scotty. She wasn't happy about that, said Donnie. She would never go if he was coming. So 2 days later, Stephanie and Suzanne, disguised in a black wig, arrived at Scotty's school. Claiming to be his cousin, Suzanne signed him out of school and drove off with him in her car. When they got to an empty stretch of road, Stephanie suddenly reached into the back seat, grabbed Scotty by the neck, and pulled him between the bucket seats. As his stepmother began choking him, he kicked frantically, scuffing the air vents and breaking the gear shift lever. When she was done, Suzanne later said, Stephanie announced, "Now all my troubles are over." Of course they weren't. Disposing of the body was one detail. The women decided to dump Scotty in an abandoned strip mine and burn him, but they didn't have any gasoline. On the way to get some, they stopped at Stephanie's trailer home. And in a bizarre touch, Stephanie called Donnie's voicemail to leave a tender message. "Hi, sweetheart," she said. "Me and Alex," which was the couple's dog, "just walked around the loop, and I thought I'd call and tell you how much I miss you, and I love you next to God." She and Suzanne then returned to the strip mine, doused Scotty's body with fuel, and set it on fire. Huh. So after 6 days, Stephanie failed 2 FBI lie detector tests while continuing to maintain her innocence. Authorities decided to lean on Suzanne in hopes that she would talk. So Suzanne cracked and confessed that Scotty had been killed, but she insisted that she had been an unwitting dupe. Suzanne claimed she thought Stephanie had simply intended to surprise Scotty, and that she kept quiet after the murder only because she was afraid of Stephanie. 14 months later, in 1994, Suzanne was convicted on charges including kidnapping and reckless homicide and sentenced to 26 years in prison. Stephanie plea bargained to save herself from the death penalty and was given a life sentence. Donnie Baker and Scotty's mom Ruth Baker are suing the Board of Education for $12 million for releasing Scotty to Suzanne Baker.
You mentioned that.
Yeah. Stephanie's baby was born 7 months after her arrest. It is now 16 months old and has been adopted by Stephanie's parents, Bonnie and Roger Spitzer. Donnie has never seen the child. He said, someday I hope to. He says they're good people. So he says at night now he sleeps with Scotty's pillow under his head and tries to make sense of a tragedy that defies understanding. No matter what happens, he said, no one will ever be able to replace Scotty.
You know, that would be an interesting case to do, I think. It is horrible.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite as horrible as the other one, but still pretty gruesome. But I would love to try to delve into it. I mean, I can sort of see the thinking of the 22-year-old wife. She's just terribly immature and resents the fact that her husband's spending time with the child and not with her.
Yeah, but killing a child?
And then I'd love to see what her friend was thinking.
Yeah, what a psycho.
And to claim that you were an innocent bystander, you didn't know that Stephanie was going to do what she did.
Right.
Wow, that just amazes me. I'd like to look into that.
Well, it's interesting, the school's liability there, too. I think they're definitely liable.
Yeah, I don't know when it became the norm for you to have proper ID or whatever.
Well, maybe not ID, but at least to be someone,
at least
a relative.
You know, who is going to be responsible for picking the child up.
Right. So. Her name should have at least been on a list or something, I would think.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it is a lot like the Kyron Horman case, which is, unfortunately, that's never been solved.
No, it hasn't.
She's still on the loose, yeah.
So maybe we could look into that one.
Definitely, yes.
Okay. So I've got a note from Mary Beth W. regarding Mean Girls, the murder of Shanda Scherer. As you recall, this is the 12 or 13-year-old that got picked up by four girls, and they spent the next day or so beating and torturing her and killing her eventually and setting her on fire.
One of the worst cases we've ever covered.
That was bad. So Mary Beth W. says, I read both books on this terrible crime. I heard Lori is due to be released in January. Is there a petition to be signed so this doesn't happen? So we looked this stuff up. We know that Tony Lawrence, who was sentenced to 20 years, got out of prison in the year 2000. We know that Hope Ripley, who was sentenced to 40 years, was released in 2004. But then Laurie Tackett and Melinda Lovelace, who were both serving 60-year sentences, as far as we know, are still in prison and haven't been able to find anything about Laurie being released in January.
No, I searched the court documents and I didn't see that, so if I missed something, just let me know. I also have one more letter from Tiffany M., She says, hello, I'm a psychological scientist from Australia, and I am a recent convert to your show. I appreciate your calm voices and find the shows both riveting and relaxing. There are a few crime cases from Down Under that I hope you will consider covering. Serial killer Ivan Milat, the police still believe he could not have acted alone. The South Australian Bodies in the Barrel, a.k.a. Snowtown Murders. The Anita Cobby Murder, and Christopher Worrell and James Miller. All of these have layers of intrigue and dark psychopathic backgrounds. Thanks for the beer reviews, too. I have never been a beer drinker. However, with the almost poetic reviews and refreshing sound effects, I find myself craving a hoppy temptation.
Oh, good for you.
So, Merry Christmas, folks. Tiffany.
I wouldn't describe them as poetic, but thank you.
So I did look up one of those just to touch on it, which was interesting. It's The Backpack Murders by Ivan Milat, the serial killer. So this was a spate of serial killings that took place in New South Wales, Australia between 1989 and 1993. The bodies of seven missing young people aged 19 to 22 were discovered partially buried in the Bolongo State Forest. That's 15 kilometers southwest of New South Wales. And five of the victims were foreign backpackers visiting Australia, three German, two British, and two were Australian travelers from Melbourne. Milat was convicted of the murders in July 1996 and is currently serving seven consecutive life sentences as well as 18 years without parole. So just looking at the Wikipedia and a couple basic things online, there are pages and pages on this one, and this is why I brought this one up. This might be one worth covering.
Okay. Well, yeah.
There's extensive information on it. Sounds like a complex case with a lot to talk about. All right, and Dick, you have one last piece of feedback for us?
Yes, fighting for change. My daughter worked at Washington County Jail when Brad Cunningham was there. This is the murder of Cheryl Keaton.
Oh, okay. So this is Fighting for Change is her online name of the writer.
Right.
Okay, so let's start over.
This is a letter from Fighting for Change, who says, my daughter worked at Washington County Jail when Brad Cunningham was there. Now, Brad's the guy who was convicted of murdering his ex-wife, Cheryl Keaton.
So that was a couple weeks ago. We covered that. Yeah.
Bludgeoned to death and then put in a car in hopes that she would be struck by a car on the highway.
Yeah, it was titled Murder Foretold, just in case anyone wants to look it up.
So Brad tried to be as big a pain to the system as possible by filing dozens of lawsuits against the jail. One was against the jail for only providing regular peanut butter rather than crunchy. He filed some suits about the newspapers the jail handed out, the way somebody looked at him, or the way they touched him. Acting as his own attorney, he subpoenaed my daughter because one of his attorneys, before he fired them all, sent him an unsealed letter, and she didn't think to just seal it, but instead sent it to him with a note telling him that it arrived unsealed. She wasn't allowed to open legal correspondence, so he subpoenaed her to court to talk about it on the stand, even though it had nothing to do with his murder case. Like I said, his whole goal was to be a pain in the side of everyone else. She was also subpoenaed for the Cesar Barone murder trial, but that story is for if and when you do that murder on your podcast.
Okay,
we'll keep that in mind.
So that's something to look up, yeah.
But it doesn't sound like Brad is any different from what we read about in the book. He's a pain in the ass.
Well, he wrote a book, Anne Rule Deconstructed, too, right, while he was in prison?
Right.
And isn't he the one who also filed suits because he couldn't have pornography in the prison?
He was.
He was just keeping himself busy by having all these frivolous lawsuits and complaints.
That's our boy Brad.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Fighting for Change. Okay, so we have a couple of voicemails. I'm just going to leave the podcast playing those. And the last one will be our Christmas song again. I'm going to play that one last time.
Okay. That's it for the last episode of 2017.
That's right. So we wish everyone a happy 2018. And you know where we'll be.
At the quiet end.
That's right. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Audra. And no matter how high my voice sounds, I am actually an adult in my 40s. I'm a true crime fan and have been for years. I have listened to each and every one of your podcasts except for Missing in Maui, which I'm attempting to do right now. I love you guys. I've tried listening to other podcasts. I just can't. I can't listen to any other podcasts. They all suck. But you guys don't suck. You guys are actually very awesome. And that's what I wanted to let you know. Thanks for doing what you do.
Though the crimes they discuss are frightful, Jill and Dick are so delightful. The Quiet End's a place to go. Love the show, love the show, love the show. The Russian Imperial Stout's delicious. Casey Anthony is suspicious. Jody Arias is a murdering hoe. Love the show, love the show, love the show. When they finally say goodnight, how I hate when the podcast is done. But as long as I hang on tight, next week there's another one. Happy holidays from True Crime Brewery. To all Christians, Islam, or Jewry, let the 12 beers of Christmas flow. Love the show, love the show, love the show.